Hello and welcome to another episode of Radio Warner. The date today is October 21st, 2024, and this is episode 478. I am the sick co-host, Mark Ames, coming to you from Western New York. You're listening to Radio Warner. Subscribe at patreon.com/Radio Warner. And I'm online with the Warner, John Dolan, a.k.a. Gary Brecher, in Dunedin. Right? You're still in Dunedin, John?
Yeah, back down in the lowlands, back out of the cold highlands of Queenstown. And Dunedin, yeah, I spent 12 years in Dunedin, really, and nobody remembers me. It's like, hey, I used to live here, guys.
I mean, anybody who's read or listen to the audiobook version of John's brilliant memoir, Pleasant Hell, would have some images and memories of Dunedin burned into their brain. And it may just be that some folks there don't think you were treated at Dunedin super kindly. I don't know. Maybe that's it or maybe not.
That's possible. I was kind in my way. But anyway, yeah.
I know you actually like it, but you know.
I do. I really do. I mean, I would have died, frankly, if I hadn't got hired in Dunedin. I was quite close to dying in those later years at Berkeley. So thank you, Dunedin. But anyway.
So we have an amazing interview to bring you with a previous Radio Warner guest, Cyrus. He was with us in episode 233. That was all of 4.5 years ago to talk about the Arab Spring. And he's back from Beirut to talk with us about Israel's wars, Lebanon, Hezbollah, Iraq. It's a great wide-ranging interview. He really knows the region very well. It clarifies a lot. It's not uplifting by any sense, this discussion, but it's great and important. And I just want to do a quick shout out to Brendan because of the technical difficulties, thanks to Israeli bombing and so on and so forth. This is not an easy one communications-wise, but it's a great one. So let's get to our interview with Cyrus. We are very honored to have with us a returning guest, Cyrus. He is a MENA researcher. He is in Beirut, Lebanon, so we'll obviously have a lot to talk about with him. Cyrus was on Radio Warner in episode 233. That was June of 2020. We did an episode on the Arab Spring and then what was going on in 2020, which seems like worlds away. But first of all, thanks for coming back on the show, Cyrus. And, I know it's not easy, I'm sure, to even talk given what's going on there. But thanks for coming on the show.
My pleasure. And no, it's quite easy to talk, technically speaking, at least.
It is, okay.
It's one of the strange things about this war, how normal life is in much of the country. Even much of the city of Beirut, while other parts of Beirut are like Stalingrad. But the all the services, poor as they were in Lebanon before this war started, basically continue to the same extent in areas that haven't been devastated. The Israelis are drawing a very clear line, very sectarian line, around the borders of the country and the city. So Shia areas are being targeted en masse for destruction. And obviously, many majority Shia areas have non-Shias living in them. The south, which is considered a Shia bastion, has Christian towns and Sunni towns. And the Beirut suburbs have Palestinians and Syrians and obviously Christians as well. While there are a few pockets of Shia villages and towns or neighborhoods in majority Christian areas or Sunni or Druze areas elsewhere in the country. And there too, they've been targeted. So there's a very clear distinction that's been made by the Israeli strikes, different perhaps from other conflicts, other wars against Lebanon waged by the Israelis.
That seems very strange in that, as I remember it, in the later stages of the 2006 war, the IDF just seemed to target every building it could get in Lebanon just to make the whole population feel the pain. And they're not doing that this time.
No, even then, there was a very clear difference. I should say the extent of the damage, the areas that have been hit are much larger this time around. So the south, of course, was badly damaged in 2006. A few parts of the southern suburbs, this time much more of the southern suburbs and the south, and the Bekaa Valley in the east. But even in 2006, you didn't really see non-Shia areas getting hit for the most part. But infrastructure was hit to a much greater extent than it is now. So infrastructure in the majority of Shia areas that have been targeted, of course, has been badly damaged. But the things which Lebanese maybe had been accustomed to in the various wars that Israel waged against their country since really the 1960s, so airports being hit, bridges, power plants, major roads, for the most part, that hasn't happened or really hasn't happened at all yet. Mm-hmm. And the threshold for civilian casualties in Gaza is much higher than it is in Lebanon. So they have warned people to leave towns, villages, entire areas in advance of bombing them, even if it's only 15 minutes or half an hour in advance. So the casualties are in the low thousands compared to what they were, let's say, the 1982 invasion, which reached at least 17,000. And they're obviously willing to accept high civilian casualties when they go after targets, and not just high-value targets here like Nasrallah, but a guy called Wafiq Safa, who is effectively Hezbollah's foreign minister, the guy who deals with diplomats, the UN. He was targeted, we still don't know if it was successful or not, in a central Lebanese, central Beirut neighborhood. And I believe 21 civilians were killed in that attack. Likewise, all the way up north, in a Christian bastion called Zrarta Ehden, there were displaced Shias were targeted. It seems like there was a Hezbollah aid guy who was delivering assistance up there. And when he arrived, the building was targeted and civilians were killed. But there's a very, anyway, so the point that I'm trying to get at is for people outside the danger zone, which is pretty clearly identifiable, life is very normal but full of anxiety because no matter where you are, certainly in Beirut, you can hear the drones above your head all the time. And even if you're not in an area which is lucky to get hit, you can hear the explosions. Some of them are so powerful that you can be very far away and they feel like it's happening right next to you. So the entire population, of course, is in a state of anxiety. And then there's been several attacks that hit vehicles on the highways in areas that also weren't Shia. So the illusion of safety that people had, even in, say, majority Christian areas that we know will not be targeted en masse, is very easily disrupted by one of these assassinations, or the fear that maybe one of the displaced people who's rented an apartment in your building or in a building next to you happens to be a target for the Israelis. So there's also that uncertainty. People are sometimes afraid of having displaced people from the south or displaced Shias rent hotel rooms or apartments next to them because you never know if you'll be a casualty, which is obviously going to lead to some social tensions in the long run.
Right. Yeah.
Obviously, there's a real sense of anxiety countrywide, in part because for many people it's confusing to understand, difficult to understand what's the logic behind Israel's attacks. Some of them seem random. It appears like they generally are going after individuals they suspect of being affiliated with Hezbollah, even when they hit areas outside what would be considered Hezbollah strongholds, which really just means majority Shia areas. But there have been some confusing incidents where nobody can figure out why they hit a building. So that does create a sense that if you have Shias next to you, you could be a target. And that will create tensions over the long run, because this will be a very long displacement. Unlike the 2006 war, which was 33 days, people stayed in schools, but it was July, so schools were out. So it wasn't a real burden on the non-Shia population. And there wasn't the same sense that if you have Shias in your areas, you might get hit. For now, that hasn't led to a huge backlash, but that has caused problems we can talk about later. But that sense of anxiety to which I referred really began on October 8th, when Hezbollah intervened on behalf of Gaza, hoping that its intervention would put pressure on the Americans and the Israelis to end the war on Gaza. So we first saw real signs of panic and mass flight in Lebanon after the Israelis hit the Al-Ahli hospital in Gaza pretty early on, I think about a month into the conflict.
Right.
And everybody thought this is going to be the big one. Now Hezbollah is going to intervene. And you saw mass flight, diplomats leaving, the international schools closing down. And for about a month, that lasted until people realized that wasn't the big one. And every few months, there's been an incident which people thought was the big one that would lead to the airport being hit, or some scenario which resembled wars they remember from the past, whether 1978 all the way to 2006. Obviously, that finally did occur following the pager incident. And of course, there was a few, even in the first 10 or 11 months, you did have a few strikes on Beirut, the assassinations of the Hamas leader in the southern suburbs, and then of Fuad Shukr, the head of Hezbollah's sort of jihadi council a few months ago. So there was a persistent sense of anxiety among all Lebanese because, they've been basically kicked in the balls nonstop really since 2019 with the economic collapse, which impoverished much of the population, already led to a mass flight of anybody that could find a job abroad, academics, doctors, nurses, etc. Then the port explosion of August 2020, which hit majority Christian areas especially hard, but hit much of Beirut as well. And finally, this war and how it escalated in the last 3 or 4 weeks with the destruction of much of Beirut and much of the majority Shia parts of the country.
Can I ask one quick question following up on what you've been saying about Israel's targeting and thinking about Netanyahu's address to the Lebanese people in English? Do you think part of Israel's strategy, look, Israel's strategy, of course, is to try to either eliminate or, barring that, at least so weaken Hezbollah that they can't really function as a threat anymore. But is part of that strategy stoking another civil war or something along those lines?
It's clear that they wouldn't mind if that happens. And it's not only the Israelis, some of their Western allies as well. In the last few weeks, we've seen a return to the neocon playbooks of 2001 to 2005, even among American officials who should know better. So there's a desire, first of all, to create new political realities in Lebanon and the Middle East in general, thanks to this perception that the axis of resistance has been greatly weakened and might even be permanently weakened. There's a desire to create some kind of new moderate Shia party that can replace Hezbollah or create a demilitarized Hezbollah. There are hopes among some that if you've weakened Hezbollah, you've therefore weakened what was perceived by some as Iran's second strike or first line of defense. Therefore, it allows you to actually go after Iran as well. And there was an attempt, or there still is an attempt, by the West, and the Israelis would certainly look upon it positively, to appoint a president now, Lebanon hasn't had one for a long time, who would not be the preferred candidate of Hezbollah or its allies, but might be the preferred candidate of the Americans and Europeans. Although a president in Lebanon has very little power, so I've seemed to me like that was a real distraction. And an attempt to impose a more robust implementation of UN Resolution 1701 and 1559, which would, in theory, also lead to the disarming of Hezbollah. These are all a bit premature, I think, but there's certainly an excitement on the part of Israelis and Americans and some of their European allies, and even some of those inside Lebanon who oppose Hezbollah. So that's one side of that attempt to weaken the party. And yes, they do have an internal opposition, of course. There are those who just never supported them, and there are those who actively opposed them and who hoped to destroy them. There had been a very powerful Sunni party that I would have in the past included on the team that wants to destroy Hezbollah. But the absence of the Saudis from the Lebanese political scene and the departure of the Hariri dynasty and their future party means you no longer have any active attempts to incite Sunnis against Shias the way you did for many years.
Interesting.
You do have some Christian parties, very vocal, some of whom who have actually been financed by the Saudis in the past, the Lebanese forces, in the past also very close to Israel. They would like to take advantage of this moment, but they're too weak by themselves. And even if Hezbollah is weakened, in the end, the largest population in this country is Shia. And almost no Lebanese wants a civil war. Right. So until now, I think we're very far away from that. But we're also in the beginning of what could be a very long war and a potentially impoverished population that might eventually take its anger out on the displaced Shias in a misdirected act of resentment against Hezbollah, whom they blame for getting them into this mess. I think that's very unlikely, though, because in the end, even if somehow the Israelis do defeat Hezbollah militarily when it comes to their border and the threat it poses to Israel, what you would end up seeing is a radicalized party in a population that would potentially lash out at its internal enemies. Mm-hmm. And in the end, they're the most powerful party. So it would be a very one-sided civil war were it to happen. I think we're very far away from that, but I can certainly imagine a scenario that the Israelis wouldn't mind that happening.
Right.
Well, in relation to that question, is Hezbollah now the only serious entity in the Shia community? Because I keep remembering the early days of Shia militant activity where it was always Hezbollah versus Amal. And I gather that Amal sort of went mainstream and got kind of corrupt. But do they still have any power in the Shia
Nabi
community?
Nabih Berri.
I think he's 86 years old now.
Yeah. Mm.
He's still around. He's still Speaker of Parliament. And he's the main Shia interlocutor for the so-called international community. And in effect, maybe the most powerful individual in the country at the moment.
Wow.
Their party still exists, of course. Now, their party had the bargain they had struck with Hezbollah was basically that Amal gets the privileges of state employment. So I think they had up to 80,000 Shias to whom they got state jobs. And that was a great deal until 2019 when the economy collapsed and suddenly a state salary was worthless.
Mm.
So Amal has suffered greatly as a result of that, while Hezbollah was able to continue paying its personnel, its massive network of civilian and military and employees and educators and people in the social side, paying them in dollars.
Mm.
So they suffered less compared to Amal. Amal's popularity greatly suffered among Shias because of accusations of corruption and gangsterism, while Hezbollah, their popularity grew both because of their reputation for honesty and lack of corruption for the most part, but also because of years of success in elevating the majority Shia population, the majority of Shias rather, from absolute poverty to a middle class existence, their success in liberating the South from Israel in 2000, their success in the 2006 war, their success in assisting the Syrian government in defeating Al-Qaeda and ISIS, and protecting the Lebanese homeland as a result.
So that was the Syrian war, Hezbollah participating was popular with local Shia, because it obviously wasn't.
That was popular even beyond the Shia community.
Really? Interesting.
Because when ISIS took over in 2014,
right,
in Mosul, you felt a frisson of panic throughout Lebanon. And many of the communities on the Syrian border are Christian or Druze. And just across the border from them were areas that were controlled by Nusra or ISIS. So even communities that would have been hostile to Hezbollah because of the political parties that controlled them, in some cases Lebanese forces, or Jumblat's Progressive Socialist Party, received some assistance and protection from Hezbollah because they were on the border and Nusra and ISIS were on the other side. Had Hezbollah failed in that intervention, perhaps the intervention would have been unpopular. Mm-hmm. But there was a perception that if we don't fight them over there, we're going to fight them over here. And indeed, there were Al-Qaeda and ISIS attacks in Lebanon. And the intervention of Hezbollah and other Shia paramilitary units from the region did help defeat this threat that would have led to the collapse of Lebanon, Syria, and Iraq. So that was also popular. And lastly, Hezbollah's threat against Israel. So there was a maritime border agreement that was concluded, I think, 2 or 3 years ago that gave Lebanon a gas field that Israel had been occupying. And now, they probably would have deserved much more in a more just world. But it's widely accepted that Hezbollah's threat against Israel and the Israeli gas installation allowed Lebanon to get a bit more of what it deserved in terms of its own maritime border and gas fields. So the point is just that their popularity had been increasing at the expense of the Amal party. Now, this war might change all kinds of equations in Lebanon. It's very early, and we still don't know which way Shia sentiment will go. But the Hezbollah and its patrons will have to work very hard to provide for their population, to make them feel compensated for the terrible loss they've suffered in what some might say was a gamble that went wrong, because they intervened on behalf of Gaza. They failed to stop the Israeli war on Gaza or affect it in any way. Nobody can deny that it was a just war. I mean, I wouldn't say it like that. Many people would deny that, who would disagree with me. They and their supporters, both in the region and even internationally on the left, and those who care about the cause of Palestine, would see the intervention of Hezbollah, Iran, the Houthis, as really a selfless act, engaging in a just war for which they had nothing to gain and everything to lose. But your own population that is now displaced and miserable and living in schools or shelters or on the street, in the end, it's possible that they will resent you. Now, it's possible that they won't, because in the end, you resent the entity that's bombing the hell out of your country and destroying your way of life and killing your relatives, obviously. But there is a possibility that Hezbollah's enemies will take advantage of this to try to move the Shia population away from Hezbollah. And we still don't know the nature of this conflict, how far will it go, what will be Israel's retaliation against Iran, if there is any, if they cripple its economy by hitting the gas fields, will that affect Iran's ability to help provide for Lebanon Shias and help reconstruct Lebanon the way they did in 2006. How crushing will this blow be to Hezbollah? They might somehow succeed, and there might be something we can call a victory. I think we're in the beginning of what's going to be a very long war.
The pager attacks, the decapitation strikes on Nasrallah and his allies, how much have they hurt Hezbollah?
Even Hassan Nasrallah, the now slain Secretary General of Hezbollah, admitted that the pager attack was a very painful blow, as was the attack which on the day that followed, which involved walkie-talkies. So the pager attack, I believe Hezbollah had 10,000 pagers, 4,000 exploded, 1,000 were underground and so didn't receive a signal, and I think 5,000 had not been unpacked. You had many people wounded. For the most part, you didn't have senior or important people injured or killed in that attack, but it was shocking in its randomness. And in fact, it terrorized Lebanese everywhere and reminded many of them of the August 4, 2020 port attack, because it was a real act of terrorism. And so many civilians were at risk, because you could be driving your car or in the supermarket, as you saw, and suddenly the pager blows up. And Hezbollah lost access to communication. And until now, they haven't fully recovered. They don't trust devices. They're not aware yet fully of the extent of the penetration of their communication. It was definitely a very sophisticated explosive that was very hard to detect. I believe it was described to me as the size of a raisin.
Wow.
That was well hidden. And it was also explained to me that the reason why the Israelis chose that moment to detonate it is because it was about to be discovered. So there was a problem, there was a technical problem. The battery wasn't lasting as long as it should have. Somebody representing Hezbollah emailed the company. At that point, the Israelis realized that it was kind of a use it or lose it moment. And in the end, that proved to be a game changer, and obviously a great escalation of the conflict, which culminated in the killing of Nasrallah. But I think had Hezbollah not been about to discover it, then it wouldn't have been used at the time that it was. Now, it was pretty clear from the beginning that there was a likelihood that Israel would massively escalate against Hezbollah. It was more a question of when, especially once they gave up on severing Hezbollah from supporting Gaza. They had tried through a variety of diplomatic means, so had the Americans, and they gave up on that and realized they had to go to war. But I think the decision to go to war was not one based on a pre-existing timetable or a strategic calculation, but as I said, this tactical issue of the pagers being about to be discovered. So that was a shock to all of Lebanon because of how widespread it was. And it did disable the party's communication system. They had been using these pagers because they were perceived to be safer than other alternatives. And I think that lack of communication forced party officials to gather and expose themselves even further. And they also were unaware of the extent to which Israel had penetrated Lebanon both through human intelligence and electronic intelligence. But I was also told by people in the party that they never expected that Nasrallah would be targeted. He was considered the reasonable, pragmatic leader of the party, the devil you know, even by many Israelis, and therefore it's better to keep him because he was a moderating voice. They also thought he was sufficiently deep that he wouldn't be hit, hence the use of this massive amount of explosive power by the Israelis as well.
What about the issue of traitors? I mean, I imagine, as with the assassination of that nuclear scientist by a remote-controlled machine gun in Iran, after which the Mossad or whoever spread the story that there were hundreds of Israeli agents in Iran, and it turned out to be a largely automated operation. So I would imagine the idea of spreading stories of spies throughout Hezbollah would be another way of damaging it, even after the assassinations.
Right. There remains a lot of doubt in the party. And for example, one reason why we don't see a lot of footage of the infantry battles taking place in the south compared to the footage we see produced by the Qassam brigades of, in Gaza. In part, that's due to the lack of trust of devices. So they still haven't, they're still conducting an investigation to understand the extent of their penetration. The penetration by humans took place not simply through the use of traitors in the organization, recruiting members of the organization. There's always been a little of that happening over the years, of course. Disgruntled employees, that kind of thing. But in the last few years, Israel got very good at recruiting people who didn't even know they were working on behalf of Israel. hiring people to take pictures of different things, film things, thinking they might be journalists, that kind of thing. And some of them were caught over the years. Obviously, not all of them. Now, Hezbollah says that in the days preceding the assassination of Hassan Nasrallah, they had been warning his security personnel that they were detecting an increased number of human agents in the area. But the security didn't think the threat against him was real. Certainly, Israel has gotten very good at collecting data on everything happening in Lebanon through controlling all the access to all the communications, cameras. It seems like even cameras in hospitals, access to cell phone footage, social media, all that stuff. And the Hezbollah leadership was also forced to gather in person. There are different rumors, unclear yet, that maybe they had not necessarily recruited a traitor, but identified a bodyguard for an Iranian, and they saw where he was going. Right now, there's a lot of rumors. The key failure, however, was in understanding the extent to which Israel had penetrated them technologically. The technological gap between Hezbollah and Israel kind of feels like Skynet and the humans in a Terminator.
Right, right.
Quick question about the banks that they're, or the banking, the Hezbollah affiliated banking network that they're targeting. Yeah, because I remember, I think I brought it up on the show a couple of times. Adam Tooze had written a really fascinating piece in the summer about that banking network and how, especially after the 2019 financial collapse, Hezbollah had won a lot of friends outside their own community by being kind of the only functioning bank for a while that could actually dispense cash and loans, small personal loans or small business loans, and that they had sort of were working with Christian communities as well. Can you explain like the reasoning behind going after the banking? Like, first of all, what is the banking network? How important is it? And then
Even calling it a banking network might be misleading because it wasn't your traditional bank.
Right.
It was more of a Chavismo kind of program that you'd see in Venezuela or elsewhere in socialist countries. And it was providing small loans for people interest-free. It did not have any link to the military side of the organization. So that's absurd. Now, why would you want to go after that? If you want to destroy the party and its connection to the population, then there's a good reason to go after that. They've been destroying everything having to do with Hezbollah, the military side, or attempting to destroy, at least, its military wing, its social wing. I think it won't be long before we see journalists who are affiliated with the party or its adjacent media organizations also being targeted. Certainly many of those journalists are in hiding. Members of parliament may also be targeted. We already saw, as I said, their foreign minister, who is supposed to be the guy, in theory, negotiating. He meets with the international officials who meet with the Israelis. He was targeted. So they're going after targets that are far broader than simply the perceived military threat from Hezbollah's missiles or its personnel on the border. If you want to destroy the organization, you have to destroy its social movement as well and its ability to provide support for its constituency, which would then make them perhaps susceptible to being recruited by some other party or movement.
Right.
Now, they may actually believe their bullshit, that this is somehow the financial arm of the organization. But for anybody in Lebanon, this is an absurd claim, of course. Now, just to go back to the question about the decapitation and Nasrallah, the extent of the damage, it's difficult to exaggerate how important Nasrallah was, not just to Hezbollah, but to the entire regional alliance called the Axis of Resistance, because he wasn't just the leader of Hezbollah, and that's where he's irreplaceable. He was the Amir al-Jihadi, basically the military commander of the Axis of Resistance. So whoever replaces him, and until now there isn't a replacement, will only be the commander of Hezbollah. There is no guy that came close to him, which is why Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei has basically assumed the mantle He was the only guy left. And the loss of Nasrallah was a massive psychological and emotional blow to Lebanese Shias, to Shias around the region, and to many people outside the Shia community, and even to people in Lebanon who might have considered themselves opposed to Hezbollah. Because this is a guy who, since the mid-90s, has been talking to you once a month, once a week, sometimes. Very familiar voice. You were raised with him, if you are Lebanese, in a sense. It's difficult to find any comparisons in the West. We don't have that kind of emotional bond with any leader. The only comparison I keep coming back to is perhaps how African Americans felt upon hearing of the assassinations of Martin Luther King and Malcolm X.
Right.
You know, somebody that you refer to by the first name, they killed Malcolm, that kind of thing. I don't know, white people in America had Kurt Cobain or something. I remember kids in my high school crying when they found out he killed himself. So there's a real gap in explaining to people in the West how important and beloved and revered he was.
Right. He never seemed to make threatening speeches to at least other Lebanese communities. They always seemed to be like even Christian happy Christmas messages. Amazing.
Yeah, once in a while there were a few implied threats to the Lebanese forces. But even then he was like, are you crazy? You know what we can do to you? Do you know the disparity in our power relations? What are you trying to do? It was more asking them why they would be reckless rather than threatening them.
Right.
And he had a real sense of humor in his speeches and was a master at switching from formal Arabic to spoken Arabic to making jokes to angry tirades. He was perceived by even those who disliked him as being honest and reliable and keeping his promises. So they knew they could trust him. And for a long time, he was beloved in a region far greater than just Lebanon throughout the Arab world. The party's popularity and therefore his did suffer due to the 2011 intervention in Syria, which was controversial. Obviously, many Syrian Sunnis, especially those who support the opposition, felt betrayed. Some of them hadn't even liked him in the first place because he was Shia, and there had been an increasing sectarian wave since the 2003 invasion of Iraq and the rise of Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State. But by the time he died, we saw that people mourned him even in Egypt, in some parts of the Gulf, in Jordan, in Palestine. His intervention, Hezbollah's intervention on behalf of Palestine, of Gaza, the Sunni cause, had restored much of their popularity among Sunnis. And as I said, even Christians who may not have liked the party felt like they lost the guy that was protecting them. And who's going to protect us from Israel now? Yeah. It's difficult for many Lebanese to believe he's dead. And in fact, some of them don't believe he's dead.
Well, that seems to happen after any important figure dies, but I would imagine.
Yeah, they didn't bury him. Obviously, how are you going to bury him when his hometown is being bombed by the Israelis? And there's a debate, should he be buried in Lebanon or in Iraq, in Karbala? So the fact that there wasn't a formal funeral has also given people false hope. But it's also just a sense of disbelief because he was such a father to so many people. As I was saying, I was in Iraq when he was killed, and everybody I know in Iraq was crying, actually crying, men hugging each other, close advisors to the prime minister crying. I know a guy who just drives a minivan. He was crying. He was perceived to be a superhero. And there is no other figure in the Arab world, the Muslim world, certainly the Shia world, that can compare. Now, Shias have an identity that's based in large part around the narrative of Karbala and the death of Hussein and his companions and of this noble sacrifice against the forces of evil, basically, which allows them to put this in some context. And it feels to them as if they've lost Imam Hussein all over again. I know a sort of upper middle class liberal Shia woman here who isn't particularly religious, but even she, and many people like her, saw this the myth of Hussein all over again. Even the pager incident, which caused many people to lose their hands, fit well into this narrative because one of Imam Hussein's companions, both of his hands were cut off in that Battle of Karbala. So even that incident can be framed in the context of the legends that inform Shia identities so much. The Shia identity was built on this notion of persecution, whether of Imam Hussein and his companions or of the Shia community over the centuries. But we've seen in the last 20 years, in particular, since the defeat of ISIS, a very different, confident Shia identity emerging. So you had a whole generation of Shias who had not experienced Israeli war, anybody born after 2006, basically. And that same generation came of age when Shia ground forces were successfully fighting Al-Qaeda and ISIS in Syria and Iraq, and their allies, the Houthis, were humiliating the Saudis.
Right. Mm.
And Shias were powerful in Syria and were powerful in Iraq.
That leads to the inevitable question. What is the position now in Sunni communities about what's going on in Gaza and in Lebanon?
So it's very complicated because we can't speak of a broad Sunni identity, but it varies from country to country. In Iraq, if we start there, Sunnis have had mixed emotions. There was a strong sympathy for Gaza. And I saw the last few years, really beginning in 2021, in the first, let's say, Gazan intervention on behalf of Jerusalem. Thanks to social media, you saw many Sunnis in the region, particularly Iraq, identifying with Gazans and becoming aware of the nature of Israel and its oppression. So that politicized people over there. And you did see a lot of public solidarity for Gaza and fundraising at a popular level among Sunnis in Iraq as well, campaigns to raise money and send money to Gaza.
What about Muqtada Sadr and his movement? Have they been active after the assassination of Nasrallah?
They are a very powerful movement, but they're a minority among Shias in Iraq, and they're a bit marginalized at the moment because Muqtada, being kind of erratic and irrational, scored kind of an own goal when he attempted a coup a couple of years ago,
right,
and ended up clashing with other Shia forces and basically getting smacked in the face and having to ignominiously retreat. And then he ended up also ordering his 70 or so members of parliament to resign, and he's abstained from politics.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. He makes statements and every once in a while tries to score points. When a Quran was burned in Sweden, his guys stormed the Swedish embassy and burned it down. Mm. Anyway, I'd say at the moment they're not the most powerful Shia factor in Iraq. You have a prime minister who has been very vocal on Gaza, and you have various parties, some of whom are affiliated with Shia paramilitary units, but not all. Some of whom are also engaged in attacks against the Americans or even Israel, who are far more powerful at the moment in Iraq. And for them, Palestine is very important, and certainly Hezbollah was a very important ally. It helped train them and assist them in the war against ISIS. It's a model for a successful Shia movement. And for them, Hassan Nasrallah was also a very beloved figure. So we have seen Iraqis take part in their own way, in support of Gaza, whether by attacking American forces early on, leading to some clashes and assassinations, ultimately leading to kind of a ceasefire in February, also attacking American positions in the occupied part of northeast Syria, as well as firing rockets and drones at Israel, and a couple of weeks ago, killing a couple of Israeli soldiers in the Golan. Elsewhere in Egypt, quite early on, we saw support for Hezbollah's intervention and obviously a lot of popular support for Gaza. But Egypt has no organized opposition movements or any politics at all. Jordan does have very organized political parties, some of them affiliated with the Muslim Brotherhood, and a population which is boiling with rage about what's happening in Palestine, in many cases because it's their relatives being killed. In Algeria and Morocco, Morocco, which you'd think would be too far away and on too good terms with Israel, there were protests after Sinwar was killed by the Israelis a few days ago. And the government has been nervous, and it's difficult for it to say anything positive publicly about its accords with Israel. Right. And obviously, if we expand broader than just the Arab world, there are Russian MMA fighters that I follow on Instagram, Muslim ones from Dagestan, Chechnya.
Yeah.
The
Dagestanis and Chechens who have been very vocal on Palestine from the beginning, including at the UFC, but also on their social media accounts. So this is a painful, shocking thing for Muslims around the world, whether Sunni or Shia. I mean, Sunnis are outraged about what's happening in Palestine. Shias are outraged about Palestine and now also about Lebanon, and the real sense that Shias are being targeted as Shias.
Right.
The picture you just painted of what's going on in these different Arabic countries from Iraq, you know, Jordan, all the way to Morocco is very different from what gets reported in the big press here. Most of it is kind of happy talk about what a great opportunity all of this is. And I mean, even, you know, New York Times and Washington Post and all of it, like there's very little on the anger that and humiliation that these wars are stoking. I mean, it sounds to me very dangerous rather than, which is very different, again, from the happy talk we're hearing out of pundits
right.
and the press.
So obviously there is reporting about how certain Arab regimes might oppose Hamas or Hezbollah, although even those regimes are a bit nervous about an Israeli madman provoking war throughout the region and the potential of impact it could have on them. But there's no doubt that there are regimes who were hopeful early on that Hamas could be defeated, and now that maybe Hezbollah and its allies could be weakened. I think those same regimes are very skeptical about what America and Israel can deliver to them. And that skepticism, we saw that in the Gulf, has led to a rapprochement between certain GCC countries and the Iranians, for example. There's also an awareness that the U.S. can't do much to protect you when a Houthi drone hits key economic assets that you have, whether you're in the UAE or in Saudi Arabia, or an Iraqi drone hits the UAE. So you're going to be vulnerable no matter what, which means you can't provoke the axis of resistance too much. But at a popular level, I mean, we've seen how vicariously traumatized Western youth are based on what they see happening in Palestine on social media and the mass protest movements throughout the West. And these are white kids that have no connection to the Middle East. So imagine if you're an Arab or Muslim and you're watching your people being slaughtered 24 hours a day, live streaming genocide. This is a whole other kind of trauma. So the rage is intense and the consequences will be far reaching. We need to think of analogies that are more similar to 1948 or 2003. In terms of like an asteroid, so this is an analogy I used in an article 8 years ago at this point. 2003 was like an asteroid that hit the Middle East and destroyed species and created new species, new identities. It ended up basically creating the Sunni-Shia identity in a way. And now this war has in a way recreated the Arab and Muslim identity.
Right, so the Sunni-Shia split might be reduced by this. It might be less important than Arab identity?
At a popular level, it's been greatly reduced. This has been clear in Lebanon, for example, where, as I said, due to the absence of Saudi and Gulf incitement of anti-Shia rhetoric, you saw the Muslim Brotherhood's local party, Jamaa Islamiyah, sending its militiamen from a group called the Fajr, Sunrise, to fight alongside Hezbollah at the border, and they lost some guys as well. You saw in some Beirut neighborhoods that are Sunni strongholds, huge amount of support for Hamas, and you saw many Sunni clerics in Lebanon that had previously been very anti-Shia and anti-Hezbollah, right from the beginning of Hezbollah's intervention, saying they would not oppose Hezbollah and they would support it for supporting Gaza and Hamas in Palestine. And that's just in Lebanon. But anecdotally, and this is all we can really go by here, I can also tell you from my experiences in other countries, in Jordan, with Palestinians, the fact that the only actors sacrificing on behalf of Gaza have been either Shias or the Houthi Zaydis, who are Shia adjacent, has earned these movements great respect among constituencies that might have been hostile to them in the past. And that throughout the Muslim world. So I do think that the Sunni-Shia rift that had been so bloody and painful from 2003 until, let's say, 2016 or 17, now the defeat of ISIS contributed to that coming to an end. And so did the end of Gulf financing for anti-Shia propaganda. But Hezbollah's intervention on behalf of Palestine also played a huge role in reducing that. And now there's a, we will see a radicalization due to the wars on Gaza and Lebanon. But I think it'll more be kind of an Arabo or Islamic radicalization. Nothing like the Al-Qaeda and ISIS phenomena that we have seen in the past.
Well, that's some good news out of this. That's, you know.
I know, huh? Cyrus, I'm curious. There's basically a blackout on any news on what's going on with Israel's invasion and you know, its land battles with Hezbollah on the border. I mean, as you pointed out, Hezbollah, because of the decapitation, because of Israeli assassinations and, you know, its electronic intelligence, they've kind of stopped what they normally would do, which is, you know, recording incidents and posting them. There's a little bit of that I've seen, but not much at all. So I guess the question is, do you have any sense of what is actually going on there? Is Israel having a tough time of it? Is Hezbollah still a well-constituted fighting force?
It's true that we don't see any footage produced by Hezbollah of its ground combat. We do know that the Israeli military has suffered losses, personnel and vehicles, killed, wounded, and destroyed vehicles in their invasion of the south. And we don't know the extent to which this has been a mass invasion. I wouldn't say it's been a mass invasion, a full-scale one. So they still seem to be probing. And to what extent are they trying to draw out Hezbollah so they can kill them slowly? They haven't made much progress, and they have suffered casualties. We don't know too much about Hezbollah's casualties. But it appears that Hezbollah as an army remains largely intact. And Hezbollah wasn't Beirut. Hezbollah is the south, where its fighters are under tunnels in the mountains and these rocky valleys and hills. It appears like that fighting force remains largely intact, and its access to its arsenal remains largely intact as well. So Hezbollah's military, its actual fighters, its infantry personnel, remain in the possibly tens of thousands. For the most part, they haven't even gone down to the south to fight yet. And they have personnel in Syria as well that who haven't been called upon. And their access to their arsenal as well seems to remain intact, drones and missiles. And we see them using this very judiciously. Just a couple of days ago, they embarrassed Israelis by targeting the home of the prime minister. They've targeted Israeli military installations despite their arsenal alleged to have been destroyed. And they're holding back on using their arsenal against Israeli civilian targets because of the terrible consequences that would bring upon the Lebanese population and the anticipation of a long war. Mm. It does seem like after Nasrallah was killed, Iranian advisors came in to help maintain unity in the organization. And the organization is now run by a council and not people that most outsiders would have heard of. And they are reverting to something more akin to what they were in the 80s and 90s, more of an underground organization, even in the literal sense, but certainly in their public sense. So there's kind of a blackout of information, and it's difficult to know exactly what's happening in the south because Israelis are controlling the flow of information. But it's clear that they were able to restore command and control. And it's also a very decentralized organization. And the guys in the south have been preparing for this day. And a lot of them are more than willing to fight to the death, especially having suffered this terrible blow of losing their beloved leader. But it's going to emerge a very different organization because Hassan Nasrallah was such a long-lasting ruler who shaped the identity and personality of the organization. And it was a very centralized rule of the organization when he was alive. And now they've lost basically so many of that original founding generation. And it's a new generation of Hezbollah guys who are going to be leading it, more of a made in Lebanon generation than the previous one. Now, it's widely believed that the older generation trained very well this new generation. And they've sent, as I said, IRGC guys from Iran and Iraq to provide assistance. And a lot of money came in. And we saw Hezbollah's social network restoring itself to help provide for the many displaced Shias after a few days of chaos as well.
The history of movements like this does suggest that, yeah, there are a few people who are charismatic and really key. But for the most part, if you have the neighborhoods and you maintain the programs in those neighborhoods, you can find new leaders.
Right. So the leaders exist because there's this new generation. We may not know them as people who follow Lebanon or Hezbollah because they'll be younger. Now, part of the problem is the neighborhoods have been destroyed. The population still exists. They may have been physically uprooted, but obviously they're still in Lebanon. And the connection with the party remains socially and also through welfare. And obviously also because in many cases it's their sons who are fighting and dying on the border. So I don't think the party is about to be destroyed. However, few organizations have suffered so many direct and terrible hits all at once, with so many leaders being killed. So we often scoff at this notion that these decapitation attacks can be effective, because if you kill the number one guy, the number two guy takes over. But if you take out the communication and so many leaders and expel the population that the guerrillas rely upon, and also make a lot of efforts to close off the border with Syria, which is essential for logistics, you can potentially greatly weaken an organization.
Yeah, that's
I think
true.
We're very early in the game, but there are some triumphant voices who, based on other victories of other national liberation movements and resistance organizations and Hezbollah's own past successes, might be too hasty in declaring victory for Hezbollah when this is going to be a very long war. And it's clear that this time around, there's no American president to tug on the leash. Every other Israeli war, really since 1956, whether wars on Gaza, wars on Lebanon, at some point, an American president said enough is enough, and the Israelis could then blame the Americans for snatching victory away from them.
Yeah.
Last question, Cyrus. Because you and I had some a little bit of back and forth about this, but I just wanted to ask what you think Netanyahu and Israel's strategy is, and how much of that is informed by the insane, domestic politics, how much informed by trying to drag the U.S. in to help fight its war with Iran, or do they want a war with Iran? How much are they trying to settle all family business? Do they want to keep the war going? Like, what's your take on that?
I think there's been too much personalization of this conflict as if it's about Benjamin Netanyahu, even by many in the American political and policy scene, while this isn't really about Israel as a country. But Netanyahu is not engaged merely in pursuing his political self-interest. This is a man with a strong ideology, one that he learned from his father, who was an associate of Jabotinsky. And these are the founders of the Israeli right.
Yeah.
And Netanyahu and people like him believe in this Hobbesian vision of the world where it's the strong versus the weak, and you're either weak or you're strong, and you have no friends, and only power matters. And they thought that they had intimidated Palestinians and other Arabs into submission, and they were shocked on October 7 to see that they had not achieved that, and that their nation experienced real humiliation and sense of vulnerability, one that shocked them out of their the bourgeoisie comfort in which they had engaged, a comfort to the extent that they could have a rave just outside a concentration camp and not even think that that might be an immoral thing, let alone a dangerous thing. So I think these are important factors to understand. The lessons of October 7 for Israel, kind of a new never again, which needs to be imposed on the indigenous population of Palestine and the region through sheer terror, so that they don't raise their heads again, especially at a moment when you realize, as an Israeli, that you're running out of international support, that a new generation in the West is coming of age that doesn't have memory of the Holocaust and doesn't have romantic visions of Israel the way the Joe Biden generation did. And even among American Jews and Western Jews, there is a loss of support. So you have to achieve facts on the ground now. And Israel used to pursue this policy of mowing the lawn every few years, killing a generation of Palestinians. Now it's mowing the lawn at a regional level. Now, I don't think they want to drag America into a regional war, because then they lose control right. over how it ends. And they may not like the way that it ends, because America will be the one determining it, and they might try to impose a two-state solution or control the terms. I don't know if we can talk about an Israeli strategy, because they've always been very weak on strategy and very effective mm-hmm. on tactics. And there are very clear divisions among the Israeli elite. There are some who want to score a small victory in Lebanon, somehow secure a deal that allows their northern population to return home. This was one of their stated goals for the operation. They've had, since October 8, tens of thousands of people displaced from the north, and since they launched this war, tens of thousands more, and people living in shelters. Those are largely the ones on the border, right-wing constituents, voters for Netanyahu and the Likud party, unlike the people who lived around Gaza,
right.
who in many cases were more on the liberal side of the Israeli spectrum, if liberal is the right term. So there was huge pressure to return those people. Now, obviously, if you've launched this massive war against Lebanon, you've probably delayed those people coming home, because Hezbollah can continue to send rockets at those people, even if you manage to clear southern Lebanon. But there are debates now in Israel between those who are super euphoric. They restored their pride after the humiliation militarily and intelligence of October 7. They've scored intelligence and tactical and maybe even military successes that have restored their reputation among their international backers. And now maybe they can change the entire region. You do see that debate taking place. How far do we go? And they do have a tendency to overstretch. We saw this in 1982 as well. And we've seen American comparisons. When after September 11, they thought they could change the entire region. Right. There is definitely a strong strain in the Israeli establishment that thinks they can do that. And there are others who want the more, who have more modest goals. And it's not clear which way they're going yet. We still don't know how they're going to retaliate against Iran. Will it be a simple strike against military targets, much like the April retaliation? Will they take out Iran's gas facilities and cripple the Iranian economy? Will they go for some kind of decapitation attack against the IRGC? That's really going to determine a lot of what happens in Lebanon and Syria as well. There is a real risk that they try to assassinate Bashar al-Assad. Early on in this conflict, they threatened to kill Assad, really right from the beginning. They sent him messages, as did the Americans, that if we're attacked from Syria, we'll kill Assad. Lately, the last few weeks, they've made those threats even more clear. And there are many in the Israeli establishment who think that the only way to sever the connection of Iran to Hezbollah, the so-called land bridge, is by killing Assad, because Assad is the key ally who's maintaining that relationship between Iran and Hezbollah and allowing for weapons to be delivered to Lebanon. So there's a logic to killing Assad, and then maybe Lebanon becomes like Gaza, kind of isolated with a hostile country on one side and the sea on the other side. I think they will end up getting bogged down, but this will be many months and a regional war, which may even include the Iraqis. You definitely have Iraqi factions that are dying to get into this fight and are so far restrained because they don't want to destabilize Iraq. But the Israelis may end up trying to kill some of the leaders of these factions in Iraq, Nujaba, Kataib, Hezbollah. I think the Americans know that if Israel does that, the Americans will be the target. I can envision every scenario except a ceasefire at the moment. But all the scenarios that I see, each one is more terrible than the other. How much of this can Jordan and Egypt withstand? Both countries are under huge amount of stress. Their population is boiling. Their economies are suffering. And any massive movement against the populations of Gaza and the West Bank, pushing them across borders, which is very realistic, could lead to explosions in both of those countries as well. If Jordan gets much weaker, you can have Iraqis pouring across the border, trying to help support their brothers in Palestine. It would hardly be the first time. Iraqi officers were the ones defending the city of Jaffa, the Palestinian city of Jaffa, against the Zionist militias when Israel was first established, for example. And they've fought Israel after that as well. So it's very easy to imagine a real regional war taking place. Very difficult to imagine a ceasefire or any regional settlement taking place.
Wow, that's really
that's
good.
A great answer. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Cyrus, for taking the time to talk to us today. This has been amazing. And stay safe as well, because you're traveling around some dangerous places. So, and we'd love to have you on again as well. But thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, I think we'll end it here. Thank you again to Cyrus for joining us under very difficult circumstances. That was a great interview. Really appreciate
Absolutely. It. Absolutely. It was a great interview under very hard circumstances. Remember, that's straight out of Beirut, as it were.
Yeah. So thank you again, everyone, and talk to you soon. Bye.
Bye.